The company names: Apple, Facebook, Netflix, Google, Amazon, Microsoft are familiar, but their presence in our lives is even more ubiquitous. We hold Apple phones in our hands to use Google to search the web for things to buy from Amazon. Microsoft software dominates the workplace environment, and then we go home to chill to Netflix at the end of the day.
So, what do these corporate giants, whose market capitalizations now dwarf the industry giants that actually make tangible things, have in common? All of them have DNA that was nurtured in what was once the sleepy California area known as Silicon Valley. So how did we get here? Simply put, why and how did Silicon Valley become Silicon Valley?
Author Margaret O'Meara gives us some answers in her new book, The Code: Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. O'Meara presents a compelling story filled with quirky characters in an amazing ecosystem of engineers and venture capitalists and, yes, even lawyers. She takes us on a wild ride from the early days of chip manufacturing to the creation of the personal computer to modern e-commerce and social media. We are so lucky to have Margaret O'Meara as a tour guide this morning. Good morning, Ms. O'Meara, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. It's fantastic to be here.
Ms. O'Meara, you describe in the book a number of factors that contributed to the development of the Silicon Valley tech industry. I want to ask you about a few of them, but let me just ask you, can you describe some of the most important ones in your view that actually made this happen?
Yeah. How do you go from being a agricultural area with not a lot going on to becoming a high-tech powerhouse? Well, there was a really important thing happened in the middle of the 20th century, which was World War II and the Cold War. And one of the big things that set the flywheel in motion was of the most entrepreneurial region on Earth was actually the public sector, was defense spending during World War II and the Cold War. And how that happened and the way in which it happened is one of Silicon Valley's secrets.
So let's talk a little bit about that. At one point, I think Lockheed Martin, Lockheed at the time, was probably the largest employer in the Valley. Was this related to the importance of Moffett Field and other sort of geographical government presences, or was it more broadly based?
Yeah, it was related. I mean, Lockheed locates its Missiles and Space Division in Sunnyvale, California, in 1954. And the presence of that piece of Lockheed, Lockheed's is still based in Southern California, along with Stanford University, become the two hubs and the centers of this new emergent electronics industry. And the two things that Stanford and Lockheed have in common, look, neither of them are government entities, right? Stanford's a private university. Lockheed is a private company. But both of them are big recipients of public defense dollars because as the military-industrial complex grew in the 1950s, there was, you know, you got to watch the industrial piece of that, right? So the way that the U.S. military has often grown and done its business has been through private companies and through public and private universities, grants, contracts, flowing money that is both for the research end of things, kind of spurring new discovery, and also developing and creating a market for high-tech products.
So as we're in the 50s and early 60s, what are the technologies that Lockheed and Stanford are working on that are sort of going to be the grandparents of the chip industry?
Yeah, well, that's the thing that sets this little area apart. Look, all the way up and down the Pacific coast, there's a lot of defense activity going on, right? Seattle, where I live, is, you know, aerospace. So is L.A. And in the Rocky Mountain West, too, there's a lot of military-related, Cold War-related activity. In the peninsula, the San Francisco Peninsula, south of San Francisco, what they're all specializing in is small electronics and increasingly transistorized electronics. In 1956, the inventor of the transistor, William Shockley, a co-inventor of the transistor, moves to Palo Alto from New Jersey, where he had been at Bell Labs, where 9 years earlier he had co-invented this incredible device. This, you know, the transistor is the, you know, it's like the steam engine for the Industrial Revolution. The transistor is the thing that sets the digital revolution in motion. It's the base invention on which all microchips, microprocessors, everything that powers our computerized world is based on. He starts his own company in Palo Alto. He's originally from Palo Alto, so he's coming home. But he's also coming because he's being encouraged and by his good friend, who was the provost of Stanford, about to be the provost of Stanford, a guy named Fred Terman, who is a university administrator, who is another really important part of this story. They're big one of the cool things about this story is there are big things that are set in motion, big policy processes, big, you know, patterns of military spending, economic trends, demographic trends. But there are also these individuals who seize opportunity and use it to build and nurture a very particular specialized industry in this particular place.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the book was that while there were characters whose names you had obviously heard of, the Steve Jobs, the Bill Gates, there were people that I hadn't heard of, like Fred Terman, who becomes, as you say, this major player. Let's talk a little bit about his tenure and why he mattered and the extraordinary influence of Stanford.
Yeah, Terman is just an incredible character, and he was so much fun to write about and to tell his story. He's, you know, kind of known colloquially as the father of Silicon Valley, and for very good reason. He is originally from Palo Alto, too. He grows up the son of a Stanford faculty member at the beginning of the 20th century, when Stanford was a pretty good school, but it was nothing like the world-class powerhouse it later becomes. And he becomes an electrical engineer. He goes to MIT for grad school. And he comes back, and he's the hardest working man in show business. He, at one point, is advising every graduate student in the electrical engineering department. He's sitting on their committee. He's just this whirling dervish of energy and activity, and he's a people person. He likes identifying talent and kind of nurturing that. And two of his students were Dave Packard and Bill Hewlett. Hewlett and Packard. That sounds familiar? They were students of his at Stanford, and he persuades them to stick around in Palo Alto and start a company out of a garage in 1939. They start this instrumentation company called Hewlett Packard, which, of course, evolves into HP, one of the companies that throughout the Valley's history has defined it and been one of its more important enterprises. And Terman, but Terman's big moment is during World War II. He, like almost every electrical engineer in the nation, is recruited into working in the war, not going and serving in the Army, but going and working for the government on research projects, many of them related to the Manhattan Project, but more broadly, research that's going to help the U.S. military develop more high-tech weapons, whether it be rocketry or bombs or other things. And one big component of that is computing and computerized communication. A lot of the state of the art is really advanced by a lot of the spending and activity that goes on during the war. So Terman goes back to Boston to do this during the duration of the war. And what he realizes is that now the U.S. government is about to get into the research and development business in a big way. That for the first time, and it hadn't done this before, that the U.S. government is not only going to be expanding its defense capacity, but it's going to be starting to invest on a permanent basis in science and technology, in higher education, in industry. And so he comes back to Stanford and he says, we need to make our university into a place that's going to be the most attractive place for this sort of research activity. This is our ticket to the big time, effectively. And so that's what he does. He comes back and with other leaders of Stanford, reorganizes the entire place to pump up its physics department, to create these new electronics labs, creates this ongoing, very strong partnership with the Defense Department and other parts of the U.S. government that turns Stanford from just another California school that's trying to compete with Berkeley to one that is truly one of the top universities in the world.
You know, it's interesting because you sort of ask yourself, you address this to some extent in the book, is why isn't Boston Silicon Valley? And one of the reasons I think you talk about is that Stanford made this decision, but also that Stanford had the real estate to make this symbiotic environment possible. So let's talk a little bit about the industrial parks and how, you know, Terman's vision sort of was fleshed out in that way and why it mattered.
Yeah, I mean, I always say that, you know, the story of American history is the story of real estate, and this is another example. So Stanford was unlike nearly every other university in the country in that it owned about 9,000 acres of real estate around its campus, that the founding grant of the university mandated that it could rent out and it could repurpose and rent out to other tenants, but it could never sell. And what Terman and the leaders of the university in the 1950s do shortly as this military-industrial activity is ramping up and they're trying to attract electronics companies to come to locate near Stanford and Lockheed and what's going on there, they develop some of that land into an industrial park. for high-tech industry, not just for startups, although companies like Hewlett-Packard and another Valley pioneer that's born in the Valley, Varian Associates, which was also founded by Stanford alumni and Terman students, but also the electronics labs of the laboratories of big electronics outfits that are based on the East Coast, kind of the big names in electronics. Because that's the other thing to remember that makes the whole story even more remarkable. If you go back to the 40s and 50s and even the 60s and into the 70s, the biggest players in electronics and computing were all on the Northeast Corridor. You just really did not, you know, you had IBM kind of, you know, eating the entire market when it came to mainframe computing. But you also had RCA, Sylvania, all these companies, they were East Coast-based, but they opened these labs and these research facilities in the Stanford Research Park and other adjacent real estate. And that draws engineers out there. And very quickly, by the beginning of the 60s, Northern California has a reputation for being the place where all the best electrical engineers are. And if you want to do small electronics, you got to be there.
And I guess that sort of sets up the move from the Shockley transistor to the chips. And when do we see the development of chips? And let's talk about how that industry developed during the mid-70s. Is that when we start seeing the chips take off?
Well, the chips, they start in the 60s, and they really start taking off in the early to mid-70s and kind of start getting, people start taking notice. And that's why, you know, Silicon Valley officially gets named Silicon Valley in 1971. And it was the person who kind of popularized the name was a newspaper, local newspaper reporter who wrote and edited a trade newspaper called Electronics News that was read by only people in the electronics industry. It wasn't like the New York Times or anything. And he kind of dubbed the cluster that was emerging there Silicon Valley. And so by 1971, you have kind of a number of young companies that have started up. But they are all less than a decade old. And what set that flywheel in motion, and this is really the first true kind of born-in-the-valley industry, is microchips. What really kind of gets that going is the U.S. space program. Because what do you need to send a man to the moon? You know, the beginning of the 60s, JFK declares we will send a man to the moon by the end of the decade, and the whole space program goes into overdrive. What do you need to get them there? You need very powerful, very small, lightweight electronic devices that can power these rockets and the computers that drive the Apollo program. So the Apollo program, NASA, is one of the biggest customers for small startups like Fairchild Semiconductor, which was kind of the first legendary venture-based startup of the Valley, founded in 1957, fortuitously founded, only incorporated only a couple weeks before the Sputnik satellite launched into orbit, which that kind of set everyone, the Americans' hair on fire because the Russians had beat the U.S. into space. And so that really sets the space program into overdrive. And by the early 60s, the integrated circuits that have been developed at Fairchild Semiconductor, which is really kind of a transistor that crams, it's a simple way to express it, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners who are in the business now will kind of probably know more about what I'm talking about. You take transistor power and you cram more of it on one microchip, on one piece of, very small piece of metal. And this is the beginning of increasingly intensified computing power, making computers faster, making them more powerful, and then eventually enabling almost anything to turn into a computer. And so by the early 1970s, this small cluster of chip-making companies that had started with a decent amount of government business, but were never defense contractors in kind of the Lockheed Martin way you would expect, they have... The demand for that the space program creates for these small electronics devices drives down the price, enables a commercial market to open up. So now you can have enterprise customers, you know, buy these very high-tech devices because they're cheap enough and they're powerful enough. And by the early 1970s, you have chips going into calculators. You have them going into children's toys. You have them going into cars. You have suddenly computing power is and software-driven computing power is starting to go into things that were once mechanical.
For those of us just joining us, we are talking to author Margaret O'Meara about The Code, Silicon Valley, and the Remaking of America. You know, you mentioned Fairchild, and we've talked about sort of the role that Stanford played in the development of the industry. One of the things that I think you also touch on in the book that I found interesting was the significance of the unenforceability of non-compete employment agreements. the fact that engineers could go. And I think one of the first places we saw that was when a bunch of engineers left Fairchild. Can we talk a little bit about the importance of why does it matter that we would not enforce non-competes in California?
Yeah, it matters a lot. It's one of those things that that makes all the difference that often isn't talked about as much. So the beginning of the chip making industry in the Valley, it starts with this guy Bill Shockley, who comes from Bell Labs, starts his own shop in 1956. You know, he is the inventor of the transistor, and he decides he's going to build a new company that's building silicon semiconductors, transistorized technology built with silicon, which was an unusual material to use at the time. Germanium was the kind of the state of the art. But silicon was actually a much better material to make these types of devices with. It was more durable. It was for many reasons. So he recruits, because it turns out he was a terrible person to work for, and this becomes very clear quite quickly to the men that he recruits to come work for him at Shockley Semiconductor. Within about a year, these eight super talented engineers who've moved from the East Coast, moved their families, they're living in California, and they all band together and they say, we're leaving. They all quit together. They start their own company, which is Fairchild Semiconductor. They find an outside financing, and they were able to do that and not get sued because there were non-compete agreements. You know, you could not enforce non-compete agreements. Now, this has continued throughout the history of the Valley, which is notorious, and it drives employers crazy to this day when you have talented employees who just hop to your competitor. And because what does the knowledge economy run on? It runs on people and ideas. So if your best people who possess the best ideas decide they're going to go to your competitor, then it's not good for you. But what it's really good for, it's really good for this innovative ecosystem. It's something that doesn't make people feel, trapped in one company. It keeps innovations and ideas, kind of disseminates them widely, so you don't have one place that is kind of holding all the goodies. And so that is an important dimension of the Valley ecosystem then and now. What's really interesting now, though, is now you have an ecosystem that's dominated by a few very, very large companies. And the battle for talent has gotten even more expensive and even more high stakes. And just last week we had this unprecedented criminal charges brought against an engineer, Anthony Lewandowski, who was first at Google working on autonomous vehicle technology, and then he moves to Uber. And before he left, apparently took a lot of files that contained information about the technologies he'd been working on at Google and developing at Google, and brings them with him to Uber. Later gets let go by Uber, but he is probably the first example I know of a kind of civilian engineer being brought before facing potential criminal charges for this. It's been very unusual.
You mentioned Shockley was a terrible boss. I understand he later was known for some rather racist philosophies. But
yes, that's an understatement.
as I was reading about the sort of non-competes in the engineers, I had this sort of image of bees, flitting from flower to flower and cross pollinating the industry. And it really is a dramatic picture that you paint. So we've talked about the role of what I call the bees, moving from flower to flower. We've talked about Stanford and Land. Let's talk a little bit about venture capital, because it seems to me that the Silicon Valley model really changed how venture capital works in this country.
Yeah, it is such an important part of the story. And venture capitalists themselves are important characters that I really wanted to bring forth from beginning to end. There is, venture capital, the idea of, people with money making bets on relatively risky, untested new industries. It's not a new thing. You have, you look at early Detroit automaking in the early 20th century, and you had similar patterns going on. But high-tech venture capital in the Valley is its own breed. It's an interesting, and one thing that sets it apart is that so many of the people who become venture capitalists and become its leading venture capitalists were once engineers themselves. They were once in industry. They were operators. We see this pattern again and again, and I think this is really critical to understanding the Valley's ecosystem and its resilience over time, you know, successive generations of companies and booms and busts, and then it comes back with some new thing. You have groups of individuals who are in one industry or company that have a good exit. You know, either they were, you know, a founder of a company and they sold it, or they went public and they have their own money that they've gained from it, or they were part of a very successful enterprise and have gained not only money but also operational experience. Then they become venture capitalists, and then they are the ones making the investments in the next generation. And they're not only putting money into the next generation of companies, they're also bringing their own expertise. They're taking these untested young guys, you know, think of Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, you know, young. They didn't know how to operate a lemonade stand, but they had a lot of good ideas and a lot of good technical know-how. And what sets, you know, enables those guys to go from being two Steves in a garage to being Apple Computer is the operational expertise that comes in with investors and executives that come from Intel, which had just been, you know, which then was kind of the star company, chip-making company of the Valley, and from venture capitalists, and from marketers and lawyers, and all of these service firms that help particularly a very young, untested entrepreneur figure out how to run and grow a company.
Given the political climate, in your opinion, do you think Silicon Valley is only focused on big business, you know, making money, or do you sincerely think there are people out there who are motivated to make the world better through technology? We've been talking a lot about the big business side and companies that we all know of and use their products. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it is a very idealistic place. And the last several years, those ideologies have been questioned and challenged in a way like never before. You know, people ask me what's Silicon Valley's politics, and I say it's politics or techno-optimism, kind of a belief, you know, whether someone is, you know, tends to vote a certain way or not. One thing that kind of holds it together is this belief that technology can improve the world's problems. So the way to resolve things is to connect people by computer, for example, to create more, you know, sort of equitable technological tools that can solve the problems we have. And what's become clear is, you know what, the world's problems are not going to be solved by technology. And in some cases, technology has made it worse. that we have, you know, we have now multiple examples of kind of the unintended consequences of very powerful platforms and technologies that are shaping our world. And you know, so I think there's, you know, it's a real challenge for the Valley. I think there is a true change the world sort of mission-driven thing. It kind of, being able to make so much money in the last, particularly in the last 15 years, I think has made it hard to really, you know, separate the signal from the noise. Sometimes the pursuit of growth, and it's so easy to make so much money, and it's very hard perhaps to veer away and choose a business model that might not have, you know, destructive consequences. And so I think this is a real turning point for tech generally, and for all of us who use tech, and for kind of thinking these broader questions, these questions of regulation and what sort of role should government play in kind of keeping this innovative ecosystem going and encouraging it, but also figuring out, you know, how do you find a countervailing balance between the power of particularly the largest tech companies and the rest of us.
And that sort of takes us to sort of the modern tension between the power of the Google and the Facebook and privacy concerns. And where do you see that playing out over the next few years?
I'm really interested to see where it plays out. I mean, in the history that I trace, you know, there are, you know, private worries about computers invading privacy have been around as long as digital computing. Again and again, you have people voicing concern that these large mainframes with their big electronic databases are snooping, you know, their big brother, they're snooping on us. A lot of the concern, and this goes back, you know, going back to the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, a lot of the concern focused on what government-owned and government-run computers knew about individuals, because at the time, the government was not only a big instigator of technological growth, but it was a big customer. Like a good chunk of the mainframe computers in the country were run in government agencies. And so think about the 60s, right? You have late 60s, you've got Vietnam, then followed by Watergate. Trust in government is not high. And so when the one time that Congress really kind of took on this question of consumer of computer privacy, it was focused a lot on kind of putting some guardrails around government and government snooping, and private industry was just not even considered. And funnily enough, you know, not putting guardrails around private industry enabled search and social and these giant companies to grow, but it also has created this privacy dilemma that is that there, you know, there is a need for something to be done, and I think the big question is exactly what, and Washington lawmakers haven't quite figured out the what yet.
As with so many other things.
In the book, you touch on the lack of gender diversity in Silicon Valley. Does it persist, and why do you think that is?
It persists. It's changing. It's changing slowly, and more slowly than one would like to see. But you know, the last 5 years or so, there's been much more conversation about that lack of diversity, whether it be in terms of gender or underrepresented minorities in tech, than ever before. I mean, it's really remarkable. And you know, historians we're like, oh, we've seen this before. And I can say, you know, we didn't see that before, even though there's been this persistent imbalance. But I think one thing my book does show, even though it's not, you know, that this is just one, when you look at the longer history of Silicon Valley, you better understand why those diversity problems exist. And part of them, the thing that I think makes them really difficult to unwind, is that part of the thing that makes the Valley go, which is this intergenerational connection between venture capitalist and new entrepreneur and on and on and on, kind of the passing the baton from one generation to the next. Again, this is a secret to its success. But that same mentorship model is also why we have these diversity problems, because so often venture capitalists are looking and they're like, I'm going to invest in the person, not just the idea. And if the person, and if you're in a risky business of, you know, choosing where you're going to put your money, you kind of want to put your bets on someone who looks like they're a good bet. And oftentimes the good bet looks like someone who was really successful before, or it's someone you know, or someone that graduated from MIT or Stanford, not from, you know, San Jose State, someone who's legible to you. And so then it's very hard to break out and say, you know what, I'm going to go and I'm going to find, you know, some kid on the slopes of Park City who has a really great idea but isn't connected to any networks I know, and I'm going to put an investment in them. This is why we have these diversity issues, but they are changing. And what changes is when you have people who are starting to invest in other people who are like them, quite frankly. So now you have more women who are becoming investors, who are becoming venture capitalists, who are becoming angel investors, who are investing in other women very deliberately. You have also the same with underrepresented minorities, and you have people who are, you know, you have men and who have been successful who are also, you know, realizing that they need to kind of put their thumb on the scale a little bit and think more actively about how you balance it out. Because you know what, this isn't just kind of the right thing to do, it's a smart thing to do for business. One of the things that has contributed to tech's problems has been that there haven't been as many diverse voices in the room making choices about what, you know, what products should we build, how should we build them, what markets should we build for, what cultural differences, if we're going to global markets, do we need to keep in mind? Those things are really important, and diversity can help that.
I know I could enjoy speaking with you for another 20 minutes or another 2 hours, but I'm afraid we're just about out of time. Ms. O'Meara, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for what is a surprisingly fascinating book. We've really enjoyed it.
That's wonderful to hear, and I really appreciate it. Great to be with you guys this morning.